KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Later today, President Donald Trump will present the details of his administration's new immigration plan, which will reportedly dramatically increase the number of immigrants admitted for work-related skills and limit those admitted based on family ties. Veteran NPR correspondent Ron Elving joins us to talk about that proposal, and we'll also get his take on more of today's stories, including escalating tensions between the United States and Iran and Donald Trump Jr.'s agreement this week to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee on matters relating to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. That's all next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Over his 20-year career at NPR, senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving has covered four administrations, 11 Congresses, and countless major political events. Ron Elving joins us in studio to talk about the latest news from Washington, including President Trump's proposed immigration overhaul and heightening tensions between the U.S. and Iran. We'll also hear his views on the state of political journalism and what it's been like covering the Trump administration. And welcome, Ron Elving. Good to have you in the flesh here with us in studio.
It's good to see you, Michael.
And, boy, there's a lot to talk about here. Are we going to go to war with Iran?
There is that distinct possibility because warships are maneuvering around each other with offensive as well as defensive weapons, and that can really depend on a split-second determination by one commander to fire a weapon that then leads to greater escalation. We saw this in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964, and of course that led to an escalation of the Vietnam War that became a decade-long struggle, cost millions of Southeast Asian lives, cost 55,000 American lives. We certainly do not want that again. We don't want Iraq again or even Afghanistan again. And these kinds of things can become almost inevitable from things that happen in the field, in the theater of operations, that no one really intends to have happen.
There's a good deal of talk that things are happening, and yet the intelligence doesn't necessarily seem to be transparent to us, and so we really don't know. It remains enigmatic.
Yes, it does. There's a great deal of opaque in all of this. We're trying to see through the glass darkly. And the intelligence community is obviously providing a certain amount of information to the administration. I know people on Capitol Hill have been talking to NPR today, saying how frustrated they are about how little information they're getting from the intelligence community. And of course, Congress ultimately has a responsibility here. We have gotten utterly out of the habit of asking Congress to declare war. Last time it happened was in the 1940s. And
well, you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. 18 years we have that authorization that's still in place.
Authorization for the use of military force is our new declaration of war. After that, the president takes the ball and runs with it.
And the president seems to be possibly, I mean, it's always difficult to detect or know what's going on in his mind, and maybe even impossible, but seems to be somewhat at odds with John Bolton, who for a long time has wanted a serious confrontation with Iran.
This is the buzz all about Washington right now. Is John Bolton actually speaking for the president? Is John Bolton really have the president's ear and his backing for whatever he wants to do? Because he has been an outstanding hawk on Iran for a very long time. And, of course, this has been a concern in American foreign policy back to the 1970s and before, but particularly since the taking of the hostages in Tehran in 1979. And many people have felt that the United States never fully asserted its revenge, I suppose is the best word for it, on Iran for those incidents and for other things. There are also those who point out that what happened in Tehran in 1979 was someone's revenge for what the United States had done to Iran in the 1950s as far as helping them choose a national leader. That's a long story. But let's just say that John Bolton has been out there as a big hawk on Iran for a very long time.
And this is the anti-Obama administration, and there's been all this criticism of President Obama not stepping up with the Green Revolution and going to essentially aid those who would presumably move toward regime change, which is probably Bolton's dream. But there are more than Bolton in this whole drama. I mean, particularly, Iran's been talking about the four Bs. I don't know what they mean that B stands for, but they're talking about certainly the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They're talking about Bibi Netanyahu, and they're talking about the head of the Emirates as being real figures. figures behind this?
There is a grand rivalry between Saudi Arabia, who this administration have really aligned themselves with on many issues. We've almost entirely stopped talking about Adnan Khashoggi and his murder in the Turkish embassy by agents of Saudi Arabia who were pretty clearly sent by the Crown Prince. And that has dented American relations with Saudi Arabia, but certainly not derailed them. We are still very much on their side in this grand confrontation between them and the Iranians. And Iraq has been yet a third player in all of that. And certainly you never talk about the Middle East without talking about Israel and talking about Bibi Netanyahu's role in all of this. So there are a number of players, and to some degree there are a lot of people who have a B name.
There are also 120,000 troops that have been deployed, and we've also got a carrier, and there are a lot of resources. I mean, things are moving forward in a way which is really unsettling.
It's troubling. The Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier has moved into that area with all of its entourage of ships. And, of course, some people may remember the Abraham Lincoln as being the ship on which was unfurled the great mission accomplished flag shortly after the beginning of the Iraq War, just the beginning. That turned out to be a terribly ironic symbol of that entire engagement. So the Abraham Lincoln is, of course, well defended by its own aircraft and by other ships, but sometimes things can happen, and there are small boats deployed carrying missiles and, if you will, asymmetric units that don't have nearly the firepower of an American aircraft carrier, but which can do it serious damage. And were there to be even so much as a pinprick against that aircraft carrier, you can imagine what the voices of the Iranian hawks would say. I'm talking about the people in our administration, but there would also be some people on the Iranian side. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard has been declared a terrorist organization by the United States. That was seen as an extreme insult by the Iranian regime. And without getting into all the roles that the IRG plays, it's very important to their politics. It's not a terrorist organization in the way we usually think of it, unless you want to call Iran a terrorist nation, which, of course, some on the hawkish side would do.
Well, the Revolutionary Guard is as hawkish in its way as Bolton is, isn't it?
In his own way, yes. And so we are in a confrontation mode here, a confrontational mode that could be resolved diplomatically because, as you said earlier, President Trump does not seem to want all this. He loves the moment of talking tough, and he does that a good deal. But he is also a master of backing off very quickly after talking tough, and he does not want another Iraq. He has been a longtime critic of that war, and he does not want another Afghanistan, which has run even longer, and he surely does not want another Vietnam. So as soon as he starts contemplating where all this could go, he starts singing a little bit different tune, and he seems to have been having some meaningful discussions with his national security advisor, John Bolton.
He also said he was an opponent of Iraq, I think, to some degree, even when that was not on the record. There was a changing of history, which the president does have a proclivity for doing. We're talking, by the way, with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. He's here with us, and we'll give you an opportunity to talk with him shortly. But I want to get into some other things with you. Just how is this playing out with Congress? Certainly, Speaker Pelosi has made it very clear that she does not want anything moving forward without congressional acknowledgement to the Congress or awareness of them. I heard your interview with Scott Simon. You were saying we're not in a constitutional crisis mainly, maybe, but we're in a constitutional confrontation with all these subpoenas being ignored.
Yes, that's true. And there's no definition of what a crisis actually is. That's just a term of art that we all define in our own ways. We are clearly into a constitutional situation because the president does not acknowledge clearly in any practical way that Congress is a co-equal branch of government and his powers are shared with Congresses. They are not just an assembly that gets together to give him a round of applause. This is a co-equal part of the government to whom he must go for every dollar he then spends. No money can leave the Treasury but by consequence of legislation, says Article 1, Constitution of the United States. And that's the ultimate power that this other institution has to check the power of the president. He does not seem to acknowledge that. So Nancy Pelosi is constantly reminding him of that. Robert Menendez, the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was on NPR today saying this is not acceptable. We are not being briefed. We are not being asked. We are not being given any information. And the president is out there on his own.
Smacks of autocracy to many, and understandably so.
It does, and that's a word that's been popping up a good deal lately because of all the other confrontations between the president and Congress over the Mueller report, over the president's tax returns, over requests that have been made by Congress under what appears to be the clear color of law, the president has said, well, you don't really have a legitimate purpose for using those laws that say that you can get access to those documents. So unless I think your purpose is legitimate, then we don't think the law that you're reading applies.
Besides, I've been completely exonerated, right?
Well, and yet, while he says he's been totally exonerated, he doesn't want the man he says exonerated him to testify before Congress.
Well, what do you suppose is going to – where is this all going to lead us? I mean, especially when the president is moving forward today, in fact, to present a new immigration plan to Congress, which probably is not going to get through Congress. But, you know, there's just all this kind of ongoing tension, and it's exacerbated, it seems, more and more each day.
It does seem that way, and we don't know where it's going to go. We are definitely in uncharted waters. We have seen presidents and Congresses in conflict before. That's part of the system, the struggle between the branches, but with the understanding that they both have a legitimate purpose in being part of that struggle. This president seems to be denying the legitimate purpose of Congress being in that struggle, and that is even beyond what Richard Nixon was doing in his confrontations with Congress in 1973 and 1974. Ultimately, in the Nixon case, the Supreme Court had to step in and say, Mr. President, you have to cooperate with Congress and turn over those tape recordings we made in the Oval Office. When they did that, within a couple of weeks, the president was gone.
Let's talk about the political effect of this now, because with the president essentially standing firmly against Congress in so many ways, and also because the Mueller report has sort of petered out, you've got a political effect now going on with this fight against abortion. You've got a political effect that seems to me on a number of fronts, the trade war, particularly the most conspicuous. Certainly farmers are being affected. Consumers are being affected. It's like a big tax on consumers. And you wonder if all this is going to move the needle at all in terms of the base. I mean, one would assume that might be the case, but that's been assumed many, many times before.
Yes, I think we've all worn out ourselves at saying this is going to start to erode the president's base because nothing seems to do that. We saw that during the campaign. We saw it in the first year of his presidency, and we've seen it well into the third year now of his presidency. And we are having to ask ourselves, is there any way that, say, 35 or 40 or 45%, let's put it somewhere in that range, of the country can be persuaded to rethink its support for Donald Trump, or at least its willingness to say that it's supporting Donald Trump, which seems more or less to be the same thing. There may be some differences around the edges there, and possibly that's where change could come. But the president would probably eat into that base if he were to get involved in an unpopular war. He may eat into some portions of that base if the trade war continues and farmers cannot be held harmless from the effects. Now, we've spent a lot of money, all of us have, about $8.5 billion to placate some of the farmers who were worst hit by the early rounds of this confrontation with China.
And he's still calling this a little squabble and still saying that there's money coming in our coffers somehow from the tariffs. Right?
Well, yes, but most of the money that comes from tariffs being paid is going to come from consumers. And we will all feel this when we buy anything that is bought from China and in the next 6 months, assuming we don't get a deal that changes everything in the next, so many weeks.
Again, we're talking to Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And how do you read what's going on with, as I said, this new immigration proposal, which probably is going to go nowhere, but there's nothing in there about the Dreamers. This is probably Jared Kushner's plan, more on the wall, more likelihood that nothing is going to go through here. But it's also kind of getting a lot of people angry on the right because we got the same number of immigrants coming in, legal immigrants, but the numbers have not been reduced.
That's right. The idea is not to change the number of green cards and other documents that allow people to stay legally, but to give them to different people, to give them to people that are deemed as desirable by the makers of this plan. And we're talking here—
It's Norwegians, right?
Well, the president at one point, talking to a group of Norwegians, said, you know, you folks are fine. We'd like to have more people like you. Even if you don't go directly to the racist overtones of much of what is being said here, even if you just look at it on its face, the idea that you can somehow say this is the kind of immigrant we want and we don't want any other kinds of immigrants is disturbing on one level. It's also impractical. people come to the border. People come to the border, as we know, by the thousands. And you have to deal with those people, many of whom have very legitimate reasons for asking for asylum. And you have to have a plan for dealing with that. And this administration's plan for that has been to abuse them, send them back into Mexico, into detention, separate the families, and so forth, and abuse the people who were separated as families. So that it does not seem to have been a solution. And while we're just talking here about that particular border, there is a larger immigration question. And are we going to go recruit people who have wealth and education and skills and bring them in and give them the green cards and say, the promise of the Statue of Liberty, send me your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, is just revoked? And by the way, the architects of this plan include Stephen Miller, the infamous person who has been advising the president on this issue, and he is the chief domestic advisor in the White House, has essentially said that that whole business about the Statue of Liberty is just misunderstood, that that really wasn't what we meant, and that that whole poem and so forth was added by some humanities major from some place at some later time and isn't really American policy. And of course,
he's also an expert on Emma Lazarus's poetry. Then,
well, let us just say that he has a very different interpretation of our immigration history, and that of course affects the families of most all of us in one way or another, and how we all got here. And it just does seem like an idealization of what Stephen Miller would like, with the blessing of Jared Kushner, who's been brought into this more or less to cement the relationship between Stephen Miller and the president and keep Stephen Miller's hand on the tiller for our immigration policy going forward.
But this policy, if they're going to move it forward at all, is saying we let people in if they can pass certain kinds of tests, civics tests, if they have skills, those sorts of things. Yeah,
this is the idea.
As opposed to the tired, the poor. Yeah.
That's right. It becomes an application process like getting into college.
And then what happens to those who want asylum?
And what happens to them, apparently, is more of same in terms of what has been done at the border. And we've had a couple of people who were, the president's chief of staff after being Department of Homeland Security Secretary, John Kelly, and then his successor, Kirstjen Nielsen, who have both gone out the door. All of us thought that they were pretty tough, that they had brought in a highly shall we say, restrictive policy with respect to immigrants and to people seeking asylum. And yet they're out, and they're out because they resisted the plan that we're talking about right now. That's why they're gone.
Talking with Ron Elving, and we're talking not only about immigration, we're talking about the trade wars and about Iran, and some of you may want to add your voices here, and let me invite you to join us. Any questions or comments are welcome, and we also want to hear your opinion, certainly. So you can join us now at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, toll-free, you can join us, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, and of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. And what's going to happen with Don Trump Jr., in your judgment, Ron?
He's going to testify before the Senate committee.
Limited time.
The Senate Intelligence Committee. And they're going to ask him questions behind closed doors for a limited amount of time. He'll doubtless have an attorney present with him. And while we would all love to be inside that closed door meeting, we might not learn that much even if we were, because this seems to have been a negotiated deal to avoid yet another confrontation over the powers of committees of the Senate to call witnesses. And by the way, the Senate is under Republican control. So this is a Republican chairman of this committee, Richard Burr from North Carolina.
But not necessarily having a run again. And so it puts him in a kind of different leverage situation.
Like his predecessor, well, not his predecessor as the Intelligence Committee chairman, but another senator who was a major chairman, Bob Corker from Tennessee, just literally decided to leave the Senate rather than run again and have to face a Trump-supported challenger in the state of Tennessee. And then, of course, Jeff Flake from Arizona did much the same, although he wasn't a committee chairman and his confrontations with the Trump administration were more on a personal level.
And can you speculate a little for us before we go to callers involved in this on what's going to happen with the president's, I think, personal attorney or attorney general, which is the case? He's talking about spies. He's talking about opening up an investigation, going back to all that FISA stuff of the Clinton administration.
He has talked about it.
Clinton campaign, excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah, he has talked about that, and they have designated a person to begin this investigation. The question is whether or not that person he's designated is going to have full subpoena power and have an actual criminal investigation open at the time that he begins. That matters because it indicates how serious they are about this. Are they really looking to prosecute people, or are they looking to placate their president?
And one more thing about the trade war. What does this mean now that this telecommunications company, Wei Wang, is in the firing line, entity list, enemy, death penalty, I guess?
That complicates everything because they are everywhere around the world. They are a highly aggressive, a high-tech company. There are questions of competition here between commercial interests, and there are also obvious questions in terms of the competition between strategic interests, their country, our country, who will build 5G for the world.
Let's bring our callers aboard. We're talking to Ron Elving, and Wynn is our first caller. Good morning, Wynn.
Good morning. Thanks. In the battle between the White House and Congress, because the House and the Senate are so divided by party and are therefore so weakened in this battle, have you seen any movement whatsoever towards Congress getting its act together to come up with a better and stronger stance in this battle?
Well, as you say, the two bodies are controlled by the warring parties. And I don't just say the opposing parties because we have reached a point where they really are at a kind of loggerheads on everything all the time in Washington. And this stands in distinction really from previous experience that I have had in Washington or studied from the past when the parties would obviously posture as rivals for the sake of their constituents and their base voters. But they would also cooperate in a variety of ways. And quite eagerly cooperate, particularly in the Senate. I was a Senate staffer back in the 1980s, and most of the senators that I knew anything about had friends on the other side of the aisle, many times warmer personal friendships in the other party than they had in their own party, and that was a big part of the way the Senate operated. That has changed. The Senate is quite a different body today. This is why so many people who ought to be running for the Senate are running for president instead in state after state. It's just not as attractive a place to make a living. It's not as attractive a place to spend your hours of your life. And those people are noticing that, and that is part of the reason that Congress can't get its act together. The other part, of course, is just the obvious part. Nancy Pelosi has a completely different agenda from Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is trying to accomplish as much as he can on a pretty hardcore conservative agenda while he still can, and with the thought that down the road, this is going to be a very different country, and people like Mitch McConnell may not be running it.
Let me thank Wynn for the call. Go right to another caller, and that's William, who wants to talk about Huawei. William, welcome.
Thank you very much. One of the aspects that I heard on the public radio about what Trump has done is that there are parts for the Huawei telephones equipment that are made in the United States and then sent to Huawei in China. And they can't do that anymore. They're cutting it off. But what strikes me is, you know, China, a country that can land a satellite on the other side of the moon, which you can't even see the other side of the moon. In other words, it has such sophisticated technology, can certainly produce their own parts.
So who's being harmed?
Say again?
So are you asking which country is being harmed if the president makes that
prohibition? Well, no, I think that if China can't get the parts from the United States, they'll just make them themselves.
All right, William,
I'm
going to have to break here. We'll come back to your question in a moment, though, but we also want to consider the fact that the Iran sanctions violation is being brought into this whole picture with Huawei telecommunications. Hold on. We're going to return with Ron Elving. More of your calls, indeed, when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Ron Elving, who is editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR. And Ron Elving is talking politics with us and the challenges of covering President Trump, which are, of course, legion. We'll talk about that more perhaps as the hour progresses. But in the meantime, let's get back to William's call before we went to that break. He was asking about technology on the other side of the moon from China and that sort of thing.
You know, this is way out of my expertise area, Michael, but it does seem as though some of the policies of Huawei have been to get as many other countries some skin in their game as possible so that they would have some policy representation, let us say, that they would have some reason for the United States to look more kindly upon them, even though ultimately there is a rivalry here. There's a huge rivalry here between our tech, their tech, our strategic interests and theirs. It seems obvious that the Chinese would be able to manufacture these parts, that they're not unique to the United States. But there are issues with some of our laws and some of their laws, and there may be, in all the complexities of this, some particular reason why they chose to make those parts here. If the president prohibits that, does that advance our interests, or does it hurt their interests enough to be part of the pain the president wants to inflict to force them back to the table?
There's also the fact that they're stealing so much of our technology, and what we are able to do with that seems to be in many ways minimal. Does the tariffs really affect that is one thought I've had. And also the other thought is I was talking to someone about who's doing business in Nairobi, and he was saying, you know, China's made so much headway in Africa, and there's a lot to do there, whereas the Trump administration, I don't know if they consider them S-holes, you know, but nevertheless, there hasn't been that kind of activity that we see coming from China.
There is an impulse in the entire Trump philosophy that could be called, if you will, neo-isolationism. America first. That's a slogan from the isolationists before World War II. And that slogan has not only been returned, it's been returned to great prominence by President Trump. And one of the elements of that is let's not invest so much outside our country. Let's not protect other people. Let's not worry about whether or not some of these other countries in the world are getting ahead, are developing, which we had done throughout the post-World War II period when we were leading the international community and leading the efforts at international community building so that there would be more prosperity in the southern half of the globe, the southern hemisphere, and that would be good for everyone. It would be good for creating markets, and it would be good for cutting down on economic refugees, and that it would be just be a better system for the world. And we've stepped back from that, and as we have receded from that, the Chinese have rushed in to fill the vacuum.
Speaking about rushing in, I have to ask you, I was talking about access and covering the president, and the White House has implemented these new rules. What's that affecting, and where you're concerned, or where journalists in general are concerned?
One of the things that they've done is they've insisted that people who have what we call a hard White House pass, in other words, something you can go in and out with every day, it's literally a hard card, and it gets you in and out of the White House fairly easily, I mean, considering that it is, after all, the White House. And yet, if you don't have one and you do have a legitimate purpose, you have to go through a process, jump through some hoops, get in, you know, what we call phoning you in. And that can take a lot of time. It's an enormous hassle. And if you're a person who wants to go to the White House, but not necessarily 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, you probably have been glad to have a hard pass that you could use when you needed to. The White House is really restricting that and saying, if you're not here every day in that briefing room, you know, if you're not going to be here whenever we want you, we're going to take away your hard pass. And so there have been a number of journalists in Washington who have suddenly been told that they are no longer hard pass holders. And, of course, those people tend to be people who have been more critical of the administration, and people who have been in the administration's corner have not been asked to give up their hard pass. So there's that. And obviously, from a journalistic standpoint, that is pressure from the White House on us to be less critical.
Let me bring more of our callers aboard here, and we go next to you, Kevin. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My comment is going to the earlier statement about needing to erode the base of Trump's support. And I'm wondering when we can start saying that it's really not just the base, because a lot of the polls I hear coming out, you got like 90% support from Republicans for Trump. And I know there can be a myriad of reasons, but it seems like the things that he does that are really intolerable, that there's a very high tolerance. And it just seems like the majority of Republicans, as well as the leadership of the Republicans, are sort of falling, not to be too dramatic, but in goose step with Donald Trump. And I'm wondering why we just keep talking about the base.
The base has many different definitions. Some people would say that the real hardcore base is maybe about 25%, and those are the people who would be with Trump literally no matter what he did. And then that there is another 10, 15, maybe 20% who have varying degrees of loyalty either to the idea that there's a Republican president, which is very important to many people. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court, the two people he's put on the Supreme Court. You look at what's happening in the federal courts across the board, where 100 new conservative justices chosen by the Federalist Society have been added at the district court and appellate levels. That's enormously important to conservatives, especially to social conservatives, and most especially of all to white evangelicals. Those voters, and they are an important part of why Donald Trump was elected president in the first place. Those people make up the hard base, perhaps, but then there are also people in those categories who make up what I would call the softer base. They are offended by much of what Donald Trump does and says, and maybe they're not with him on immigration, maybe they're not with him even on the environment, but they are so with him on the things they support, they do not want to give any kind of comfort to his enemies by saying to a pollster or to anyone else that they have any kind of problem with him being president or that they don't approve of his handling of his office.
But we can always remember, though, the aphorism, it's the economy, stupid. And if this trade war, with China continues to hit hard, it really could have some serious impact. I mean, you know, we're in a situation now with the GDP, low unemployment, the economy is humming along. The president continues to, you know, tweet things that put him into harm's way, perhaps politically and with many people's opinions of him. But at the same time, he's riding a really good wave here in terms of the economy.
You know, this is the dilemma, to some degree, of the China confrontation, which is that much of it is way overdue. And really, there have been things that have to be addressed in terms of this relationship. You mentioned intellectual property. There are requirements for technology transfer in order to do business in China. There are a lot of restrictions put on by the repressive Chinese regime, which is an enormously repressive regime, which, among other things, has viciously oppressed the Uyghur people, the Muslim people, in their control. And we have cooperated with a lot of that, and we have also sat still for an awful lot of outright theft of our intellectual property. And that needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed somehow through the negotiating process between the countries, preferably without hostilities, preferably without a trade war or any other kind of war. And preferably that would happen over a longer period of time. But what the president has made possible here is a more frank addressing of those issues. And that's a good thing. That's something that needs to have happened at some point. So on the one hand, you have a lot of pressure on the president to hang tough in his confrontation with China. But what's going on in his mind, one suspects, is he's thinking, how is this going to play next year? Is this going to, in some sense or another, take the shine off the economy? Will we start to see the numbers come down a little bit? We're into the 11th year of this recovery, started in 2009. And so we've had 10 full years.
But trade wars could lead to recession, and
that's certainly
likely in many ways, isn't it?
Yes. And a recession, some people used to say recessions have to happen sooner or later. Now, we probably know we're on the end of this long recovery uptick, because we're starting to hear people say, you know, maybe recessions aren't really necessary. Every once in a while, we get to the point where someone starts to make that theory popular. That may be a sign that this recession is closer than we might have thought. I think most people are thinking next couple, 3 years it has to happen. But the trade war, as you suggest, could move up that timetable considerably.
There's Mimi who asks, what can Congress do to stop the administration from starting a conflict in Iran?
Well, eventually Congress can deny the president the funds, or if he comes and asks for an authorization for the use of military force, they can deny him. Right now, I don't think it would pass in the House of Representatives. Some question whether it would be popular in the Senate. But ultimately, it depends on how the question is brought. If the president does it seemingly to please John Bolton, his national security advisor, no, Congress will not go along with that. If, on the other hand, confrontation begins and there's hot shooting war happening in the Persian Gulf, God forbid that the Abraham Lincoln should take a serious hit from any of the Iranian military assets. One doesn't want to imagine these things too much, but if something of that nature happened, then we have a Gulf of Tonkin situation.
I was thinking Tonkin Bay immediately.
We have a 9/11 situation.
Right.
And Congress, in those situations, well, certainly when you're looking at the invasion of Iraq, Congress had a lot of information that would cast doubt on the weapons of mass destruction theory, but it wasn't enough. And a lot of Democrats went along with voting for that war. Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden voted for that authorization for the use of military force because of the hangover of 9/11 and the fear of weapons of mass destruction. If we got into a hot shooting situation in the Persian Gulf, that kind of pressure would return.
What do you make out of taking personnel out of Iraq?
That's troubling, too, because I think there's a sense, and you're hearing officials in Iraq trying to tell people to settle down, calm down, not to do anything that would be provocative. There's a whole other world of politics in Iraq and some of these other countries that we almost never talk about and have only dim perception of. And so there can be a hot boiling pot that we're just not even aware of because it's not on our stove, but because we're over there in their kitchen, it's ultimately going to hurt us if it boils over.
Our guest is Ron Elving, and we're going to go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Navilla. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Michael, I have a question for you. Did I hear you right when you said 120,000 troops had been already deployed to the region? I just want to make sure that I heard it right. And plus, we know that President Trump himself challenged New York Times yesterday and said, if we go to war with Iran, we need more than 120,000 troops. And as far as I know, the troops has not been deployed yet. So could you please clarify that?
No, also, thank you. Let's clarify that. This is a Patrick Shanahan number that I'm talking about here, Ron, right?
Yes, that number has been bandied about, but it all depends on what you mean by deployed. Right. I mean, we're certainly not sending 120,000 troops to confront the Iranians. But these numbers get thrown around, and the very fact that it is eye-opening or hair-raising is the idea, I suspect, that the use of that kind of specificity, as though it were in progress and the war is on, as it were, I think is meant as a form of pressure and also as a way of preparing the public for what could happen.
Yeah, I'm sorry if there was any impression that is indeed the case. It's not fait accompli, but it's as Ron said, it's been bandied about a good deal, and I thank you. Listener writes, when Ron Elving is on a show like Forum, the language used in talking about the president is fair but also direct about things that are unusual or alarming. But when I hear news stories on NPR, especially in the newscast, there is often no comment about things that are highly unusual or untruthful. I fear these things have become normalized. Can Ron please discuss that?
This is an enormous issue in journalism. How often do you say this is unusual? How often do you say this is unprecedented? How often do you say that's just not normal? In fact, it's actually been the subject of a Saturday Night Live skit in which they mocked the way people on CNN would shout over and over, that's just not normal. And we as journalists feel that we are required to be as step back, look at this calmly as possible. But at the same time, we need to describe what we actually see. And what we actually see is oftentimes quite disturbing. We have different, let us put it this way, we have different purposes in different parts of broadcasts. We have discussions such as this one. We have what we call news pieces, where a reporter sits down and tries to really tell both sides of something. And we have the newscasts, which are largely taking the first few paragraphs of any story, the headline in the first few paragraphs, and trying to get the essential facts out there with a minimum of characterization description of what this might ultimately mean. We leave that to what comes after the immediate newscast.
And we go to more of your calls. Here's a caller joining us from San Jose. And do I have your name right? Simak?
Hello, yes. Yes, thank you. Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Simak, and I'm calling to talk about the Iran war. I'm extremely worried about this war escalating. Hello?
Yeah, we're hearing you, Simak. Go ahead.
Yes, I can hear. And especially the role of the media and how it's being reported. This is a war. If it happens, it's a war entirely of America's making. By stepping out of the Iran deal, it would have guaranteed peace for 10 years or more. And now kind of making themselves a target, that is America going there and say, hey, shoot at me so I can start a war. This is a devastating thing which will cost millions of lives, including probably lives of my own family. It's entirely unnecessary, and the media is somehow both-siding it. Like, oh, yeah, Iran is also doing this. No, this is entirely of America's making. And my question is also, how can Congress prevent that? Do we need a supermajority, or is it sufficient if we get, 50% in each chamber to vote against the war?
Simak, thank you for the call. Get a response from Ron Elving.
Well, here again, the authorization for the use of military force is, I believe, just a majority vote. In the House, it's not going to get it unless, as I said earlier, we're under some sort of extraordinary pressure because of war having already, in essence, begun, and particularly if it is perceived that that is an attack on us by them. I don't know if that would be the case, even if it were reported that way, and we certainly got an education over the years of what really happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964. I keep going back to that because it is a somewhat similar situation, and it led to such disastrous, tragic consequences. So I totally understand, I think, as much as I can empathetically, with the caller's feelings. The caller obviously feels the way people who are involved with Venezuela, who are Venezuelans and living in this country, feel as they see things playing out there. And when we are accused of both siding issues, I have to say yes. That is a pitfall of trying to tell the full story, is that it sets up what some people call false equivalence. That on the one hand, these folks say this, these folks say that. Sometimes we try to compose the differences. Sometimes we try to say this side's a little righter than the side over here. But it's always a problem, and it's never satisfactory in the final resolution. It's an imperfect science.
Well, let me thank Simak for the call and go to some questions from listeners coming through email. David writes, my recollection is Obama also did everything he could to avoid Congress and do anything unilaterally that he could.
After the loss of the House in 2010 and the Tea Party election, Barack Obama tried to work with the House and Senate, but the Senate remained Democratic for another 4 years. But certainly it was difficult to work with them from that point on, as Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader now, and at the time was the Minority Leader, said, our agenda is to make Obama a one-term president. And that is not exactly an invitation to cooperation. So we had a fair amount of pushback from the Republicans. That was what they were there to do. And we're seeing something very much like that today from the Democrats. Certainly the new majority Democrats in the House were elected to be a check on Donald Trump, no question about it. And the Republicans who came in after that 2010 election saw themselves in very much the same terms. And Barack Obama later on said, okay, look, I've got a veto pen, I've got a phone, I can write executive orders. And he changed a lot of our immigration policy by executive order, and then found that third branch of government gets involved as well, as a district court down in Texas and then an appeals court for the South said, yep, that executive order, nope, that can't be enforced. Nope, Mr. President, you don't have the authority to do that. You would have to change the law. You would need Congress. So in his attempts to end run Congress, the president's batting average was not all that high. Sometimes he won, sometimes he lost.
This may be a prognostication type of question, but when you talked about the Tea Party, I often see a parallel between the Tea Party fracturing the Republican Party and then the party moving more and more to the right. Now the fracturing of the Democratic Party with AOC and, you know, those who are on the left is occurring. Does it mean inevitably that that party will indeed go more to the left?
Perhaps not inevitably, but that right now seems to be the way to bet. And the reason for that is largely generational and it's largely demographic. As we go forward into the 20s and the 30s, the Generation Z that's coming up behind the millennials, as the millennials are no longer the fresh new kids on the block, they are the largest, by the way, in the workforce and the largest in the electorate soon, if they're not already the largest generational group in the electorate. And the Gen Zs are coming up behind them, and they are more liberal. They are decidedly more liberal on questions than even the millennials, who are more liberal than the baby boomers or the Gen Xers or the silent generation. And all of these characterizations, of course, do have some basis in the years in which you were born and some generational basis beyond that. What I'm saying is the younger people, the people who are supplying the younger people, which are largely the communities of color, which have much higher birth rates, those communities are pulling the Democratic Party to the left, and they are going to dominate the Democratic Party in the 20s and 30s. The younger people and peoples of color and women voters who are becoming increasingly interested in protecting things such as reproductive rights.
And we go to another caller joining us, Anjali from Mountain View. Good morning.
Hi, I have a question regarding the immigration reform. Me and my husband, both of us came to the U.S. over 10 years ago as students. And since then, we've had jobs here and we are assigned the temporary working status. We've been contributing to the economy in various ways, home loans, car loans, and we have been active consumers of products. So my question is, why shouldn't we be incentivized for our active participation in the economy with a faster green card process?
Well, I certainly can't think of a reason you shouldn't be. I would certainly not want to take that side in a debate. it would seem to me that this immigration, your particular immigration situation, as you describe it, is a classic idealized immigration success story. But as you know, there is resistance, certainly within the Republican Party, and to some degree, there is resistance among older generations of Americans to the idea of demographic change, however it comes about. And they would like to slow down this process, make it a little more difficult for you to become a full citizen voting, and make life a little bit more difficult, in part to discourage your full participation in the political side as well as the economic side, which you're already participating in.
And again, our guest is Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington Desk for NPR News, and also a local angle. Ron is a graduate of Stanford and also got a master's degree in journalism. After getting a master's in English at the University of Chicago, got a master's in journalism from the University of California, Berkeley. And this is a planned fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, we urge you to go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Fairfield next. Wayne, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Brian in his opinion what it would take to reintroduce civility into both Congress and the House, and to reintroduce some level of nonpartisanship when it comes to the various laws that we're trying to introduce during this period of time. It just seems as though we're at such extremes that there is no middle ground any longer, and getting rid of somebody like Mitch McConnell is not a solution, because there will be somebody that will come up in his place.
Well, they are talking, Ron, about some kind of bipartisan move toward infrastructure, those sorts of things, you know, moving beyond the aisle. But the caller raises, I think, an important point, and it's Nancy Pelosi's point. How are you going to get work done when, well, for example, she wants to stave off maybe an impeachment process for that reason? Mm-hmm.
It is extremely difficult to restore norms of behavior that have fallen by the wayside as people have been rewarded, frankly, for ignoring the old rules. People have been successful in our politics by blowing things up, by tearing it up, by being anti-Washington, by being against the old understandings between the two parties. And I understand this energy. I understand the populist incentives that people have felt for getting involved, younger people and people who have perhaps lived a whole life and felt that their way of life is being devalued by our politics today. The white working class, if you will, that's a cliche. But both young people and older people who feel that their way of life is being devalued are asking to have our politics blown up, and are rewarding and incentivizing politicians to be incivil, to be uncivil, to be uncooperative with each other, because they don't like the good old boy, one hand washes the other, slap you on the back kind of politics.
How much of this comes from the top? I mean, you know, you think about Trump and what has often been characterized as his bullying and his obstreperousness and his rigidity and all of the autocratic things we alluded to before. He's leading the pack here.
He may be leading the pack, but he is not entirely the cause. I think, in fact, I would rather argue that he was more a symptom of the deterioration of our national conversation, the deterioration of our dialogue with each other, and the fact that people are so eager to go to conflict and confrontation with each other. And this is reinforced largely by our media, both the television media and other kinds of media, and particularly by social media. If you live on your Twitter feed, you think you're really, really, really right about everything. And all of your friends are reinforcing that belief, and you're reinforcing their belief, and you're telling each other what to read, and you're never hearing from the other side. And that is an environment that will lead to people like Donald Trump being highly successful in politics.
Another caller joining us. Matthew, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you please remind us exactly what Iran is doing that Trump finds as a justification for war? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Ron Elby.
I'm probably not the best person to ask this question, and it is not really my reporting focus. But my understanding is that the Iranians have been positioning assets, which I assume means moving missiles around. And by missiles here, I'm not talking about intercontinental ballistic missiles, but smaller missiles, some of which might be capable of reaching Israel. So I think a lot of these moves may very well have to do with the longstanding animosities between the Iranian regime and the Israeli regime. And there, of course, has been much back and forth there, and there was much talk years ago that if the nuclear deal did not restrain Iran's development of a nuclear weapon, that the Israelis would literally send warplanes to do so. That has not happened. There was enough debate over that in recent years that people actually asked, would American aircraft carriers accept the Israeli aircraft returning from such a raid to refuel, to save those aircraft? Those kinds of questions have been around for years. So what exactly they've been doing in the last, say, weeks, months, to re-excite these tensions, I'm not actually sure.
Israel is a big part of this, but wasn't there also, and there's no evidence of this, talk about proxy groups in Iraq and Syria to essentially attack U.S. forces?
Yes, and that's some of the intelligence that we are not seeing that is apparently—
As I said, no evidence, really.
Either being delivered to the White House or delivered to elements of the White House, but not necessarily delivered to Congress. As we said earlier, Robert Menendez, the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says he has not been given the kind of information that the White House seems to be acting upon. If it exists, he wants to see it.
Ron, always great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you in the studio, too, for a change.
Thank you, Michael. It's a real pleasure.
Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And stay tuned for another hour of Forum. Up ahead, Dan Brecke is going to join us to talk about the campfire. The report is finally in, and PG&E is being held culpable. And then we'll talk about Andy Warhol, big exhibit at MoMA, and it's an exhibit that covers 40 years and about 300 works. And Andy Warhol may not have been the artist some of you thought he was. Stay tuned. That's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.